Welcome to the ONC PCORP Research Data User Scenarios Workgroup Meeting Number 3. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone, stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Priscilla Dulab.
Great, thank you. Welcome everyone to the third multi-stakeholder meeting for the PCORP Privacy and Security Research Data Use Scenario Initiative, so phase one of the project. My name is Priscilla, and joining me, I have other members of the broader NORC team. From NORC, we have Eric, Gagan, and Catherine. Our colleagues from GW include Jane, and Lara, and Elizabeth. We also have Daniela Mika, Noam Kaderu on the phone. And then from ONC, we have Helen Caton-Peters and Debbie Mesa. So I know that there are quite a few people that are sort of joining the call, as we sort of introducing things. I'm going to quickly mention who we sort of noted already joined the WebEx. If I do not call your name, please be sure to send Catherine Donaldson a note. We are not going to ask people to introduce themselves individually, given that there's a large number of participants. Okay, so far on the from the multi-stakeholder group, we have Carmen Rosa from NIDA, we have Kurt Mueller from HRSA, we have Jason Doctor from the University of Southern California, we have Kevin Haynes from HealthCore, we have Laura Mona from the National Institutes of Health, we have Lisa Lee from HHS, we have Lucy Johns, an independent consultant from the Healthcare Planning Policy Group, and we have Marissa Gordon Nguyen from the Office of Civil Rights. So there's probably a few more folks that are on that I haven't mentioned. We'll be sure to take note of your name, and we will include you in the list of participants for this meeting. Okay? Next slide, please. Okay, so for the call today, next slide, we have sort of three main areas that we want to focus on. So we've already had two calls where we sort of introduced the project more broadly. In the last call, we went into more specifics around the project charter and the research data use scenarios in terms of sample topic areas and topics that we would like to study under this. So with this particular call, we are going to walk through some specific research use scenarios focused around combining data sets. And for some of you that participated on the call the last time, this is one of the ideas that was brought up by the multi-stakeholder group. So the focus of this discussion will be to share with you the relevant questions that we are looking at for each of these scenarios, and to sort of outline, you know, what we are going to be looking at as we develop the use cases that come out from these research scenarios. And Daniela and Ioana will be walking us through this. As we talk through the scenarios, we are really hoping that the multi-stakeholder group will have other ideas in terms of research scenarios that we can explore. And as I had mentioned on the last call, you know, you can certainly sort of share your ideas on the call, or you can reach out to us separately, and we are happy to have one-on-one calls with you where we can dive into more specifics around the research data use scenarios. And then we're going to focus on some example scenarios, again, that were brought up in the last meeting, focused on behavioral health. And Eric Goppelgroup from NORC will be discussing this with the group. And then I'm going to finally wrap up with just some process and logistics updates. Okay, next slide, please. So just moving us along, we're going to start sort of focusing now on the deep dive that we've done on the research data use scenario focused on combining data sets. I'm going to hand it over to the team at GW to talk through some of the relevant questions that we all are sort of considering as we think about the requirements associated with each of these research use scenarios. Lara, Jane, I'm handing it over to you.
Wonderful, Priscilla. Thank you so much. This is Jane, and we are appreciative to have this opportunity
to walk through what we think are some of the key questions that we'll be considering as we walk through the data research use scenarios throughout this call and then in future discussions as well. We also thought it might provide a little bit of a foundation for the group as well as we're considering the various scenarios that we'll be discussing. So when the GW team in collaboration with the broader NORC team has been thinking about the research data use scenarios and the types of information that we will be looking for that will help us align what's happening in practice with legal and ethical considerations, we thought through a set of questions that we think we will want to be answering as we're thinking about these research data use scenarios. And we, again, thought it would be helpful if we presented these to you at the outset. And I think what you'll find is that these themes will be coming up over and over again as we walk through the various data research use scenarios and as we talk through some of the issues and the challenges that you all are facing. So the questions are there for you on the slide. I want to point out some key ones in particular, and I think these are very relevant to combining data sets as well as issues around mental health and substance abuse. So again, as we move forward with these discussions, we'll be coming back to these common questions frequently. So things like, you know, what are the sources of the data? Who is actually holding the data? What types of data are being requested and ultimately combined? Who is requesting the data? So it's almost like a newspaper report, the who, the what, the why. That's what we're looking for very much from a legal and an ethical perspective to understand how the data is moving between parties and how it's being used. So that's what those logistical questions are aimed at. We also want to make sure that we understand what arrangements or agreements are in place between the parties that may be sharing or exchanging data and how any principles that are included in these arrangements or agreements govern, again, the exchange of the data or the movement of the data between parties. And again, we want to make sure that we're understanding the purposes that the data is being used, and particularly when we're thinking about combining data sets, what is the ultimate purpose of the use of the combined data set itself? Thinking then a little bit more about the data itself, some of the issues that we'll be thinking about relate to whether or not a consent or authorization was obtained for using the data or exchanging the data. And, of course, a very important issue, whether or not the data is identifiable. And so that will always actually be a preliminary question for us because a number of legal issues hinge upon whether or not the data itself is actually individually identifiable, whether or not it's partially de-identified, and whether or not it's de-identified. And, of course, the very important issue of whether or not the information can be re-identified also will be implicated as we look into these issues with these research data use scenarios. And another issue as we think about the use of particularly combined data sets for broader purposes is whether or not there are any fees associated with obtaining the data. And very importantly, we want to have a sense of, from the research community in particular, are you experiencing any barriers to collecting or using or accessing data? We really want to make sure that we focus on any challenges that you're experiencing, any barriers that you may be experiencing that may limit or impede what you would like to do, again, if there were greater flexibility in the legal structure itself. And then a few other questions, mainly focused upon, you know, sort of after the research is completed, what happens to the data? What are the obligations associated with that data to be returned to the original source or destroyed? Are there any available secondary uses that may be considered? And again, if so, that may trigger some of the consent and authorization issues that we'll discuss. Security is obviously a significant issue, so we'll want to think about how the data is secured, both and from its original source in transport and then ultimately by the user. And then trying to think through, again, as this data is moving and being used, who is the data being disclosed to and, again, for what purpose? So you'll see there's definitely some common themes among these questions. But, again, we hope that as we move forward with our more specific questions led by Ioana and Daniela, that these questions, we'll all have these in our head and be thinking about these elements of these examples as we're discussing them. So, Priscilla, I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Next slide. So, Daniela, I think it would be great.
Priscilla, when can we ask questions about this slide?
Sure, we can ask questions now. Please go ahead and ask your question. And who is this?
Okay, this is Lucy Johns. I'm joining the group for the first time. And there are two questions that seem to me are key, and perhaps you've addressed them already. The first is, once data are obtained, who owns it? The researcher, the institution for whom the researcher works, what? To me, that's a serious legal question. And secondly, what are the provisions at the recipient of data prohibiting sale for any purpose?
Yes, thank you. This is Jane from GW. Those are both very important questions. I think the concept of ownership has a number of different implications, and we're trying to reach at that through the concept of any agreements or arrangements that govern the relationship between the entity that is sharing the data and the researcher that is using the data. Also addresses the question of when the research is complete, you know, what happens to the data? Does it need to be destroyed? Is it returned to the original user? Does it belong to the researcher? So I think several of these questions actually are aimed at sort of that concept of at any point in the process, from the source through transport to the user and then any secondary uses as well, who is responsible for the data and what are those legal responsibilities that are associated with that. I think your second question about a sale of the data, that's again encompassed in our questions that are addressing, you know, how, for what purpose is the data being requested, how is it being used, are there any fees associated with that. I think that's a really important issue, especially now we're seeing more and more efforts related to sale, marketing, et cetera, use for commercial purposes, of large data sets in particular. So thank you for raising those.
Well, maybe if the bullet point, what arrangements, agreements exist, could add a clause saying, in particular, who owns the data once it is obtained, this question would have been moot. I don't know whether people normally ask for agreements. I mean, I don't know who's going to be auditing any of this. So the more specific the questions are, the more helpful it seems to me the answers will be. As for charging fees, I think that's really a very complex issue. You can charge fees for service, you can charge fees for data, and then you can sell the data to somebody who wants it. So I don't see that those financial dimensions of data are addressed here specifically enough.
This is Elise Berliner at ARC, and I have a related question to that because, you know, so it seems like the people who own the data or, you know, that they can choose who to give the data to. So I agree with that idea that the fee might actually restrict, and then even more than that, they might have policies where, say, they don't want to give data to someone they perceive as their competitor. So how are you going to deal with all those issues?
Exactly, and those, sorry, this is Laura, GW. Those are all elements of, or aspects of the data sets that we want to find out about. So those would be examples of agreements. Sometimes it's a function of state law as far as ownership. Some states have laws that give ownership of data to certain people, and that might need to be modified by a contract or a data use agreement or what have you. Sometimes there's issues like patent law that might apply or things like that. So those would be sort of aspects of the data that's being used and combined that we would want to find out about. So that certainly should be included in any scenario if there are features like that. But ownership alone is not enough because, you know, the law, of course, gives people rights with respect to their data regardless of ownership. So it's sort of just it's one important element of the data.
So this is Ed Hammond from Duke. Just two comments, one of which is, you know, this focus on ownership makes me a little bit nervous because I think there are other categories besides ownership, and a use agreement is probably what we really are talking about when we are accumulating data from multiple sites. So ownership is not as much an important characteristic of the requirements and agreements as far as the use of the data. The second question I have related to this set of things. There is one other scenario that I'm not sure is quite addressed, and that is where I'm creating a registry, for example, moving data into that registry that will continue to be updated over time for an individual. So from a perspective of moving the data into the repository, into the registry, and linking it with the same person, I need to know who that person is, and I can use, something other than identify can use an identifier that's only known to the system, not anybody else. But the access of that data is going to be in a non-individual basis. So I think that framework has to be accommodated in here as well.
So I want to thank everyone. These are really great questions. And Ed, we might be coming back to you as a group to sort of talk to you a little bit more about sort of the scenario you're describing, because I think that's exactly what we're looking for, some sort of examples from the field that we can build out and then, you know, sort of explore these questions and others that may be relevant. So I'm going to move us along and get Daniela and Ioana to talk this through a specific example scenario. And so you can see how we sort of taking the scenario and instantiating the questions, you know, within the scenario. And then I'm also hoping that, you know, we can have a discussion with the multi-stakeholder group on additional scenarios we ought to consider. Daniela?
Hi, everyone. Happy New Year. I hope you've all made a New Year's resolution to resolve all of the privacy and ethical problems that we're facing in doing KeyCor. It's certainly great to hear everybody's voices. So this particular scenario, I kind of want to specify how this relates to all the other things that people have been bringing up in the earlier slide, because it may seem very narrow, and you'll see that we've made a number of assumptions and we developed it. The idea behind this is to take off, you know, something that is reasonably digestible while breaking other use cases, for example, creating longitudinal identifiers into their own can of worms that we might be able to unpack in a future session. So even within combining data sets, we're focusing mostly on the idea of combining clinical data sets and claims data sets within this particular case. And on only one possible architecture for doing this, we know that there's many different ways that we can adhere to the current constraints of legal and ethical boundaries and architect them in many different ways. We've taken the approach for this particular case to consider that there's a coordinating center that's facilitating the kind of data sharing that might be used in this case. And the role of that coordinating center is different potentially from other coordinating center roles that people might have considered. But the idea here is to try to unpack what's happening at, you know, at an abstract level for a series of transactions. So we set it up as a Max researcher at Advanced Research Institute has already obtained IRB approval to conduct a particular protocol under the Human Nature Study. Using the list of patients that have been approved in that protocol and that are identified already by a research unique identifier shared across all of the different sites that the coordinating center facilitates data sharing, Max then loads this list of research unique identifiers into an information system and submits it to the coordinating center. Next slide, please. So this is where this slide includes sort of all the different mechanics that have to go on from the time that a patient list has been identified to one possible set of sequence of events that could lead to a fine data set. So in this case, the coordinating center would receive the request. It then maps the research unique identifiers to the site specific identifiers, enabling the sites that have data pertaining to that patient list to retrieve the relevant data elements that have been approved for that study. It then creates a technical criteria that corresponds to the human readable criteria that the IRB approved. So this would be turning a human readable phenotype into a computable phenotype for the patient population that's to be retrieved. It then would submit the technical criteria to each of the data sites, and each site would return the matching list of patients as it's been described in a pre-existing data use agreement, which is also a part of this story that we may break out into a different discussion in and of itself. And in this case, then the coordinating center processes the different responses for the matching to the patients to the list and returns the correct set of patients to the Advanced Research Institute's internal research information system. And then the research information system creates a data set so that the goals of the original protocol can be achieved. So again, this is just one way in which, you know, we might be able to achieve that these sequence of transactions that might be occurring in this particular use case. The next slide. And so, you know, to take this into sort of the description of the case, the actors, and the different participants and the preconditions. I've gone through sort of the description here at length. The primary actors in this are the end user, whereas the supporting actors are the coordinating system and each of the data marts or data sites. And all of these different bullets here, these six different bullets, are the things that we've kind of assumed out of the different transactions that are going to occur so that we can address them in potentially future discussions and future cases. So there's already a standards-based interoperability that's been assumed across the different sites so that they can share the same technical criteria. The researcher has IRB approval. All of the agony associated with using PII to create unique identifiers has been achieved, so we're at that hurdle. The coordinating center has provided the identity correlation, so all of those negotiations have been completed. And there's been a mapping that the coordinating center has done between the current patients and the data sites. And then there's already the existing DUAs and other kinds of agreements have been executed, so that we won't be, in the course of the transactions that we're considering for this particular use case at this moment, we won't be considering those things. Although one of the things that I hope we'll speak to kind of towards the end of this session is really how much we're brushing over when we're assuming all of those things have been done. And then I think the next slide is talking about sort of what are the outcomes that we have here. So, and Iona sort of encouraged me to sort of work through these things in this level of structure. So the post conditions would include sort of the outcomes are the information is sent electronically, so it can be analyzed and combined for this specific study. And the alternatives in this case that we would have to consider is the IRB or the DUA has expired. So that the researcher should, their access to that data should be constrained then until such time where either the IRB has been renewed and the UA has been renewed.
So, and again, if we have any sort of details about the data and whether the data can be persisted after the end of the study or whether it has to be destroyed, this would go under the rubric of post conditions. So if we know that information already and we can record it and we can make it part of the use case analysis as well. Back to you, Danielle.
I think that the remaining elements on this slide sort of speak to the sort of other things that even came up earlier on the first slide that GW presented around, you know, what are the data elements, what was the purpose, and what kinds of terms. So these are the agreements. In this case, it's a DUA. Another case might have terms that are subject to a consent that's been executed or a notice of privacy practices. And then the terms of the data release to the researchers are not only subject to the other release items, but also the researcher's governing body, which is his native IRB.
And Hammond, again, I would point out that there are requirements for keeping data for a certain period of time after the research is completed, simply for provenance and re-executing some of the research. So I think there are other factors that we need to be aware of as we begin to answer these questions.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's what we're trying to accomplish. We're trying to record these here, so we built some consensus among the stakeholders. And once we have these concepts laid out firmly, then we can answer the privacy and ethical questions that Jane was elaborating earlier.
I think Jason's doctor also has his hand up. Jason, go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. This is really nice. One thing that always concerns me, that you had mentioned brushing over, that we can get to talking about brushing over certain things. But one thing that always concerns me with coordinating center data or basically any type of transfer is inadvertent disclosures. And I didn't know if we wanted to consider any sort of checks or safety checks around inadvertent disclosures. They're not reportable under HIPAA as data breaches, unless that's changed, but they are a high risk for transfer of PHI that's not supposed to be transferred. And a lot of people working with the data are not always aware of some of the fields or that they have PHI in them, and I didn't know if we wanted to consider those safety checks around inadvertent disclosures, even in a very well-governed environment like this.
I think that's a really important point, and probably, I mean, I defer to the rest of the group, but it seems like that might be a case that could cover a lot of different data uses beyond just this one. Even a single transfer could result in that kind of a disclosure, and how we detect that and adjudicate it, and what kind of notifications are important. I really like. The opportunity to explore that case more and how it fits into the larger matrix of things that are under consideration here.
And we can elaborate those explicitly, so it's very clear that there are certain obligations under which these data brokers are supposed to operate.
And this is Laura TW. I just want to say that's the kind of thing that might fall outside the current legal or regulatory structure that we want to identify and highlight, that maybe there's a problem people aren't aware of, or something that's happening that's a policy gap. So something like that would be, I think that's exactly the kind of thing that we do want to identify.
So I want to propose that, you know, maybe outside of this call, we actually reach out back to you, Jason, and then we can work with you, you know, to sort of build it out in with more specifics, okay? But we really appreciate you bringing it up on the call.
Sounds great.
Were there any other hands raised, Catherine? Otherwise, I'm going to move on, Daniela. Kurt, go ahead. Kurt, there's a question from you. Please go ahead.
Oh, just a quick question. Are you assuming that the data are physically housed with the researcher, or is it housed someplace remotely?
In this particular version of the architecture, and this is definitely narrowed down to a particular case, is that the assumption is that it's a federated network for the purposes of the larger data sets, and a single data set that was fit for the purpose of use that the IRB had approved would be transferred to the individual researcher after the approvals had been obtained. So the architecture here is there's a larger data set that contains a large amount of information about a number of participants in multiple sites, and a very specific subset of the data would be transferred to the researcher under the terms of a particular study.
Okay, thank you.
And actually, this will be apparent in the following slides, by the way, because we're actually breaking down the various participants to this use case.
Yeah, now maybe that's a good segue if you want to sort of move along.
Sure, yeah. So the narrative scenario gives you a story about Max researcher and a day in her life and how she plans to go about retrieving data and combining data sets to support the human nature protocol within her research study. So this is a breakdown of that exchange as it pertains to the various systems that are involved in the exchange. So we have the researcher operating on the research information system, and this research information system, as you can see here, and I try to highlight the elements of interoperability that point out that the information has to flow between covered entities, and that's a lot of our interest in this privacy and ethical framework. And as you can see here, the whole activity starts with a need to initiate a data analysis protocol that requires data from multiple sites. And based on a pre-selected list of patients identified by a unique research ID, the research information system will send a request to the coordinating center system, which in turn will forward the request to the appropriately mapped sites which are physically storing this data. And presumably for all of these sites, a request would go out. That request would be evaluated by each site against its own data use agreement. And based on that, it will respond with the appropriately matching data set that matches the end user criteria to a set of objective technical criteria. And then it returns that data set back to the coordinating center, which assembles a comprehensive response that goes back to the research information system that makes it available for analysis. And I think this is where we have an opportunity. I tried to illustrate for our discussion specific data points. For instance, the data site has a decision to make whether to return the data, part of the data, or a specifically identified set of data that is defined in the data use agreement. Similarly, as Jason indicated earlier, there may be some requirements or some conditions that the coordinating center has to meet, and there may be a business rule there that specifies how to respond to a query and how to appropriately address the data use agreement criteria. This particular workflow you see would actually work in the case that the data use agreement or the research has expired. And let's say this is happening after that grace period at the end of the study where some data may, information may be reprocessed. So that depending on how the data use agreement is set up, the data site may no longer support additional queries. And therefore, instead of a data set, the coordinating center would return a set of errors or failure notifications back to the research information system to allow the researcher to know that they can no longer access the information. On the next slide, we have a set of identified preconditions. So what we do in that initial story we tell about Max Researcher is to identify what should have happened prior to the start of combining the data sets. So a use case is named typically based on the objectives it's trying to accomplish. In this case, the objective is to combine data sets for the purposes of research. And in this case, we assume all these different activities that you see here identified in yellow are supposed to have happened before that. The protocol was approved by the Institutional Review Board. The data use agreement was entered between all the various data sites and the research organization. In some cases, we also assume that the coordinating center here to support this type of workflow would have mapped the patient's records to the appropriate site and to their appropriate research unique identifier, and therefore provide a sort of enterprise-wide access to the individual data sets. So again, we're trying to drill into what is going on so we can adequately evaluate the questions that Jane had identified earlier.
This is Lucy. I just want to comment that I find these diagrams excruciatingly useful, and I want to thank you for the thought that went into them. And now
I'm sorry, but that excruciating scared me for a second there. So.
No, really, really. This is how all of this needs to be thought about with diagrams like this, with question marks all over the place about what are the legal or ethical or other considerations to think about. So I just have one question right now, which is the concept of data use agreement. Does this project or does anybody anticipate a standardized data use agreement that all entities in the country would use for purposes of research that we're talking about? Or is legal counsel in every organization going to be drawing up a unique data use agreement that then every other enterprise in the country that wants access to their data is going to have to send to their counsel? And, you know, this could go on for months, if not years. So could you clarify data use agreement?
Hello, this is Jane from GW. I think that's a really good question, excellent comment, and something that we grapple with all the time, frankly, not just in terms of data use agreements, but also in terms of thinking about consent. I think, you know, similar discussions around whether or not there are some type of uniform consent documents that could be used more broadly rather than having everything, you know, as you say, go to outside counsel and all the realms of review that we currently, I think, experience now. And I think that's one of the issues that we want to raise, frankly, is we're looking at this issue and we're looking at the data flows, is identifying those junctures where such agreements or relationships are necessary, what the underlying legal requirements for them, and then I think we can offer thoughts on how to streamline those processes from a legal perspective, mm-hmm. such as using, you know, common language in business associate agreements or common consent forms, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
This is Bob Gelman. Could I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead, Bob, and then I want to give Melissa a chance. I think she has a hand up as well. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not on a computer. I can't raise my hand. I want to ask about a different type of data. And we're focusing on patient data, which is, of course, perfectly fine. But when a researcher says, I want to do some kind of research, and goes to whatever system there is, and inquiries go around saying somebody wants to do this kind of research, that information about who's doing the research and the nature of the research, have you thought about whether that information requires any degree of confidentiality?
This is Laura at GW. Yes, so one of the questions we want to ask is, and one of the features of the data we want to capture is, does it include information about anyone other than the subject? So, for example, the physician, the treating physician, the researcher, you know, information about other people. You know, there's been, there's research that's done on provider prescribing behavior, for example, where the research is about the, you know, a particular provider that's not hidden. And that sort of information we want to make sure that we include, and then we can discuss the legal implications of that.
Well, I'm not sure you've gotten my point exactly. A researcher's inquiry may make, a researcher may consider his or her inquiry, the nature of that research, to be confidential and doesn't want other people to know what kind of research is being done and whether that interest will be considered and does it deserve protection.
I think certainly that could be included in a research scenario if that's something that the research, if you got, you know, the research community thinks is important, an issue that is not addressed currently, that we should, or even if it is something that we need to map, then yes, I would say that could be a good part of a scenario.
Well, it's something to think about.
This is Priscilla. I think that what would be helpful is, you know, even now, even outside of this call, if you have like sort of a specific, you know, example, if you can give us an example, and then I think we can start working, you know, with you and the group here to sort of unpacking it, looking at all the different sort of aspects and, you know, the questions that we went through. But definitely something I think that, you know, we are willing to explore with you, okay?
I have an example. Not at the moment, however.
Okay, no problem.
This is Eric Larson. I don't know whether anybody can hear me, but I'm also not following the slides, but an easy example is almost all the proprietary companies, say the drug development companies, all the research that they would be doing would consider under their intellectual property and considering anybody knowing the questions they were working on would have an advantage over them in terms of the competition to develop a new drug.
Okay, that's sort of an interesting example, so we should certainly sort of explore that further as well, okay? I think that if I have this straight, I know Lisa Lee has had a hand up. Lisa, you want to go and ask the question?
Sure, this is just a comment back to Lucy's point about the data use agreements and whether they should be standardized or by individual facility. Just to, not to complexify things, but recognizing that the IRB is very interested in not just the protocol, but the parts of the protocol that deal with data movement and privacy protections, confidentiality protections around the data movement. So I think that in this figure, it's a little more complicated, and the IRB is very interested in how data use agreements protect individuals, whether the minimum data set is actually non-identifiable, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So the lines from the IRB reach out to all of these other yellow circles.
So the IRB would be involved in the data use agreement. Would they be reviewing and approving or just reviewing, or what do you think would be their involvement in the data use agreement?
Their job is to ensure that human subjects are protected, so they would want to ensure that that's happening. They could certainly say, this data use agreement is not robust and this person or these subjects would be vulnerable, so we won't approve this without changes in that, for example. I mean, that's just an example, but they might also say your minimum data set, you know, it does not meet the requirements that we think are necessary for this this type of thing.
So they literally would contribute content to that data use agreement. They would say this is what the data use agreement has to provide.
They could, potentially, yes. Now, one of the advantages of a standardized form is if somehow we get, you know, everybody to agree that there's a standard form, then IRBs would have to deal with the fact that there's a standard form and this is what it is. But if we, I just want to be sure that we recognize that the IRB is interested in much more than just the protocol. That protocol includes all these other yellow boxes.
Okay.
This is Jim Walker. I agree. I would also suggest that many, perhaps most IRBs would be very grateful for a format that was regarded as representing national standard of practice, and for many of them, their performance would be dramatically improved by such resources.
I completely agree with that comment.
So would that be a situation where there would be a standard boilerplate and then each protocol would have its own, perhaps, data set identified? Is that how you see that happening?
I would suggest that if there were forms that were regarded as consistent with national standard of practice, IRBs would still have the option, should still have the option, to modify them if they want to, but most would not.
Mm-hmm.
I think relying on IRBs for responsibility or accountability for protecting data in this new realm is a big leap. And I want to plus one the comment that guidance, if not standardized forms in all directions, should be an option and should even be, I'll just stop there. But people are on IRBs because they're experts on research topics, not because they're experts in data flow and protection of data flow through vast infrastructure that they know nothing about. So let's drill down on the IRB and try to make a contribution in the course of this project about responsibilities that doing research in this manner is devolving onto IRBs, and what sort of assistance would they need?
And this is Lisa again. They would need expertise in the movement of data around. They're very interested in protecting the subjects of the research, and if that means protecting their confidentiality, ensuring data are protected, et cetera, that is where they would need expertise, and maybe in addition to the topic matter, subject matter.
Every institution isn't going to have that expertise or be able to afford it, so let's be realistic about responsibilities that we would like IRBs to fulfill and point out where assistance or standardization could be helpful.
So I want to thank Lucy and Lisa. I also want to give Marissa a chance to ask a question from OCR. Marissa, go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. This is Marissa in OCR. I think it would be helpful to provide more in detail, more specifics about the information that is being disclosed in each of these, the data flows in the workflow analysis and the use cases. It's not clear for each disclosure what information is going, and its level of identifiability is what's really important. And if it's intended for the scenario that every disclosure involves only a limited data set under HIPAA, then that certainly should be specified. And then I have a question about, on slide 8, one of the preconditions says that unique identifiers are used to request data to protect the identity of patients so they cannot be re-identified. So Could you explain what is meant by that and how that fits in with the idea that there would seem to be limited data sets involved here but not de-identified data?
This is Daniela. I can take a stab at this. So I think that this is by far, in my mind, one of the largest assumptions that we've made in this in terms of a precondition. But the idea behind this is that a HIPAA-compliant identifier is shared by all of the entities that might be contributing to the data sharing process. And so agreeing on how that identifier is created in a way that is consistent with the terms of HIPAA for not having an identifier that's derived from the identifiable data elements is a really large challenge. A number of us are struggling with this, you know, on a day-to-day basis right now. And I would love to actually unpack that particular question as a separate story that we could work on together.
And I just want to emphasize that that's the precise purpose of these preconditions. So if there are certain preconditions that deserve their own use case analysis, we can take that particular issue of how research unique identifiers are allocated to patient records in such a way that they cannot be used to reverse engineer their identity and explore and delve deeper into that particular topic.
Certainly. I think also just to be clear that when you're doing other scenarios that aren't necessarily specifically about a research unique identifier, that it should always be clear the level of identifiability. Also, of course, you know, which entities are actual HIPAA-covered entities in your scenarios. But if what it sounds like you're saying is you're actually looking for de-identified information that would have
Right.
a unique identifier that would be permitted under our de-identification standards, then that should be specified right up in front. So that people understand that actually HIPAA is not applying to these flows of data because they're de-identified. And then explaining the basis for the data use agreement, given that, you know, if it's de-identified, HIPAA wouldn't require the data use agreement. I know, of course, the DOAs are used in other circumstances, but just to help with analysis of all of these flows, some of these, the basic preconditions should be very clear.
So, Ioana, did you want to make any further comments on this slide? Because I think we wanted to move on to the next one.
Sure, I think we're ready to move on.
Okay, great. Okay. So, Daniel, do you want to tee up, and then I think we were going to ask Kevin to make a few comments as well, okay?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think one of the inspirations for this particular discussion was some of the work that had been done in a related working group to this one, but very focused on this particular use case of combining clinical and claims data. So, I wanted to tee this up to you so that you could sort of also comment on some of the issues that have already been raised in the course of this discussion as well.
Yeah, thanks, Danielle. And actually, to build on some of the previous conversation, you know, I think it's really challenging. So the mini Sentinel and PCORnet working group got together to try to figure out how Sentinel data partners, and for those who aren't familiar with the Sentinel data partners, imagine sort of the large insurance providers in the country, and the PCORnet, for those who aren't familiar with PCORnet, imagine the clinical data research networks that are the collections of health systems data. And really, as you come together and you realize that in order to have the longitudinal data follow-up that you need, you kind of need both sources of data. And so this work group got together to really start talking about the legal and ethical obligations that constrain payers and health systems and providers and employers from sort of entering into some of this data sharing. And so if you take the example of the PCORnet demonstration project, there's the adaptable trial, which is a large pragmatic trial, which is actually going to have informed consent. And that's great for IRBs and data use agreements and legal scholars and everything else, because the patient is informed that their data is going to be linked with other data that, that they have generated, right? But there's also the observational studies, the pediatric obesity study and the bariatric obesity study, where for years I've written IRB to IRBs, like when I was at Penn, and I would write an IRB that said, you know, we're going to keep the data confidential, locked in a closet behind two firewalls, et cetera, right? We're not going to link the data. But here we're getting into a situation where you have to link the data for the purposes of the research. And I think that these begin to set up some of the straw man discussions that I think this work group really would be challenged to start to tackle. For example, my two boys are members of the PEDS net in CHOP. And if they're identified to be in the PEDS net obesity project, you know, they would need the longitudinal follow-up that's at Independence Blue Cross Blue Shield of Pennsylvania. And so somehow to understand and to be able to get the data and the longitudinal data of the antibiotics that are outside of the antibiotics that that are identified and prescribed within the CHOP system, you need this longitudinal data. And so how do we move forward with putting in the governance in place to allow the sharing of that data?
I wanted to ask if there were any questions. Can we still have some questions, Catherine? Elise, did you have a question? Please go ahead.
I just had a completely different issue, which was that the patient is not in this at all. So I guess you're thinking that, you know, because it's de-identified and it's post-use of data already collected, there doesn't need to be consent. But from an ethical point of view, and considering that this is patient-centered outcomes research, there's also the idea, and there was a Hastings Center report a couple of years ago that I was going to send to you on the chat, but like that the idea that patients should be informed about what research is going on, even if their consent is not required, and that they should also be involved in the research protocols and things like that. So, you know, I mean, I think that just because of the patient-centered outcomes research, you know, the model that you have is a very, you know, not the way that people think about patient-centered outcomes research.
So, you know, this is one example. I think we are very interested in sort of exploring other scenarios with sort of the patient at the center, if you will. And we are looking to sort of the work group to, you know, share some of those ideas so we can start building them out.
Right, but even in this case, you know, if a patient found out that this research was going on with their data and they had no idea that it was going on, you know, I mean, why should it only be certain cases? Why should, you know, that this idea that any research should be going on with the patient's data that was going on in secret without telling the patient about it?
Point definitely taken.
Well, the adaptable trial is getting consent, so those patients will know that they're being participants in research. For the obesity studies, there is not, because they're observational, the discussion has been around that it's not feasible to collect consent and notify the 600,000 patients or whatnot that would be included in those studies. And patients have been involved in research without their knowledge for a long time within single centers. But now that this is starting to breach the need to data linkage, you can't do that with de-identified data, right? So I'm at Anthem, and Nationwide of Ohio can't send me a de-identified data set and ask me for the data on those patients. That won't work.
No, but the paradigm that people are talking about is that, say, like, Anthem could send out newsletters to all their patients all the time. So there could be in the newsletter a listing of all the research studies being used with Anthem data. I mean, that way patients are informed of what's going on and that they don't find out later and get all upset about it.
This is Lisa. Somebody mentioned, and I'm sorry I didn't catch who, about the Hastings Center report on the learning health system. And I think that while that was a look at the ethics around the learning health system, much of what's in there looks at what could legally be done at this point in the context of the common rule and research regulations. I think it's worth, if people haven't taken a look at that supplement, to do so, because a lot of the work that we're talking about here really has been done in this larger context of a learning health system, regardless of whether that's within a single agency or healthcare provider network or across providers and such data owners like we're talking about. So I think it's worth all of our being up to date on that topic.
So thank you. This is actually a very sort of, important discussion, and I think we really appreciate sort of all the considerations that we need to be mindful of. I just wanted to ask, Lara and Jane, did you have any comments that you wanted to make based on this conversation?
Just that this has been incredibly helpful, and I think that people are talking, are raising the issues that we need them to raise, so I think this has been great. I think that's it. Thanks, Priscilla.
Okay. So we are going to be at time in 2 minutes, and I know everyone is sort of, going to disappear at that point. So a couple of things. One is there are a few folks that brought up specific scenarios on this call that we would, want to go back to, so we will be in touch. We have actually developed or started to develop, two scenarios around behavioral health that we will make the focus of the conversation for the next meeting. So we've already sort of started including some of those ideas in the slides today. I want to thank Dennis and I think it was Leslie that met with us to sort of start developing these scenarios. Outside of this call, if there are other sort of scenarios and examples that people are sort of encountering, within their current sort of research and efforts, we would really appreciate it if you get in touch with us, and then, we can sort of work with you outside of the call to develop the scenarios, and we can bring them up for broader discussion like we have today. Kathy, can you move on? I just wanted to also point out, in a way, we sent out a link to the website where we are posting materials, the Confluence website. At your own convenience, you can certainly look at the website, but we'll be posting all of the materials that we've received or that you've been receiving up on the website as well. Okay, so I think with that, I'm going to actually suggest that we, thank everyone. We really appreciate all of the input.
Excuse me, could you please talk about meetings? There's a slide with future meetings. Are these dates fixed, and what times are these meetings?
Sure. So, yes, Catherine, please bring it up. So these dates are fixed, and all the meetings will take place at 1 p.m. Eastern, like the meeting that took place today. If folks have not received holds on their calendar, they will be receiving holds. Catherine, can you confirm? I thought you put the holds on.
I will be sending the rest of them out today.
Okay. So everyone will get holds for all the upcoming meetings, on these days at 1 p.m. Eastern. Okay? Any other questions before we sort of wrap up? I know 1 minute past the top of the hour.
I'll just make a plea. This is Karen Rothenberg. If you happen to be in an academic setting, and Wednesdays at this time are often when there are meetings. It's in the middle of the week and it's around lunch. And this means that because it's the same time and the same day, if you've got a scheduled meeting in an academic setting, you won't be able to make any of these. And I appreciate that, but I'm in that situation. So
Karen, I think we do have a large group, and we're trying to sort of accommodate both sort of our East Coast and West Coast participants. But, we can certainly be in touch and figure out if there's another way we can still gather your input, and contributions. Because I do
or even if you just scatter the days, you know, so every other meeting you could make, even if you have to set the time at time, you know, if you just scattered the days as a possibility. But I'll do the best I can. I just wanted to point that out as a challenge.
Okay, thank you. It's truly noted. And we'll give that some consideration. So I want to thank everyone. This has been an excellent conversation. I think we as a team have a lot here that we, you know, can work with. And we'll be in touch, okay? And we'll meet with everyone again in 2 weeks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.